Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for July 7th, 2022, and last week I left off, I was talking about Russian work, my collaboration with Russian scientists, and the discoveries that we made together by going back and forth. They were experimentalists. They had a lot of data on the atmosphere and the solar atmosphere in relationship to Jupiter. They had seen tornadoes on the sun. They knew that hurricanes were not caused by warm water, but they didn't know what caused the hurricanes or why they would move in a westerly direction, all of these different things. And so anyway, they picked up on my work, and instrumental in that was a man named Earl Crockett, who is deceased. And like I said, I'm not going to mention names of people who are still living. As a result of the discovery of Hale-Bopp, there was a web page that was developed by an individual, and I became an essential part of that. All of my work on plasma discharge comet model, etc. It was called the Millennium Group, and there are still bits and pieces of that around the internet. You can still find bits and pieces of it with my work attached or commentary. But what was very interesting about this, of course, the whole webpage was centered around this whole controversy relative to Hale-Bopp, the companion of Hale-Bopp, which NASA denied now, but they had let the video out from the Hubble Space Telescope clearly showing the companion orbiting Hale-Bopp, and a very big companion, two comets, one comet orbiting the other comet. But what's interesting about this webpage is it was getting millions of hits per week. And at the time, there was a way of tracking these, and they were all coming from the military, from the Pentagon, from the, you know, various military services. So all of these high-level military people were coming to this site on a daily basis. And so clearly, this whole issue of Hale-Bopp was amazing, huge topic. And then 1995, it had not lost any of its orbital, what would you call, momentum. And so it was still, when it was first discovered, it was on literally on a direct collision course with Earth. When I say direct collision course, literally within about a million miles, which would have put us inside the coma of the comet, which made me do some calculations. And I realized that, yeah, this thing would, Earth would be inside of the coma of this comet for a period of about 40 days. That was my calculation. And then additionally be in the electrical discharge, all of the electrical activity. And then I realized, wow, this is something like happened to Moses. Moses, clearly. But also Noah, the Noah's flood would have come from this. And so very clearly Noah's flood was the Earth passing through the tail of a large comet for a very long period of time. They say 40 days and 40 nights, but as I've stated before, the 40 days, when they said Christ went into the desert for 40 days, 40 days was a figurative number. In other words, so many that you can't remember. And so it may have been longer, it might have been 80 days or something, but a long period of time, more than you care to remember or that you have the ability to count. It was 3, 4, or 5 days, then you'd probably remember. It was 3 or 4 or 5 days. It was 10 days, maybe you'd probably remember back in the old days, though they did not have timepieces, they did not have calendars, etc. And so, I mean, they may have had, but when you're in these stressful, extreme conditions, it's not like you have your Timex watch on or your tablet where you're marking off days, etc. And in the case of especially in Noah and Moses, during these big major comet crossing events, the sun is blotted out. You can't even count days. It's dark all the time for a period of time. And so anyway, the whole issue of Hale-Bopp coming on a near direct collision course with Earth was on top of the top of the top of the list of anything military, etc. And of course, they were very interested in keeping this information from the public. I mentioned Malachi Martin, and so he was a regular guest on the Art Bell Show. So all of a sudden, I'm a regular guest on Art Bell Show. And that started a series of interviews. And one thing we started doing was an annual Christmas show. And I remember, that this is in the later 90s, sometimes I would go up to a resort to do this radio show with a phone line set up for the show. And one night we were talking about the Russian space program, etc. So anyway, this led to a collaboration. I remember being on the radio show with Whitley Strieber, who was a co-host with Art for a lot of shows. And of course, Whitley had written the book Communion, which dealt with some type of experiences that Whitley had with aliens, or the alien experience, I guess you could call it that. But at any rate, this time of collaboration just was like an explosion of new contacts, of new outlets for my work, of amazing amount of interest in it, especially for Tier 1 science. The Russians coming, basically communicating with me, and then the collaboration that followed to understand all of these issues, where I ended last week's show. I was talking about the different discoveries that were made between myself and the Russians. I talked about the X-ray experiment of on the sun, showing that the solar fusion was up in the atmosphere. I'll go into a little more detail on that, that if you scan across the disk of the sun with an X-ray detector that detects all, like say through the full spectrum of X-rays, so you can see the energy level of the X-rays, you start on the one side of the disk and you start going through and you measure the X-rays. Okay, that's the surface layer of X-rays coming from the surface of the sun. Now, if you scan in a little bit more, you're getting the X-rays that come from a little deeper in the sun, plus the X-rays that were coming from the surface of the sun, but it's coming, okay? And so you subtract off the spectrum that you took from the very surface of the sun, and that leaves you with the spectrum of X-rays coming from deeper in the sun. And you keep doing this process as you scan across the entire surface of the sun. And so what they got to was, they got to a point in which the solar, the X-ray output was not changing. And so that indicated that they were getting X-rays from the surface of the core of the sun. It turned out that the core of the sun was cooler than the atmosphere, proving that the atmosphere of the sun was the source of fusion. But there's a problem, because the atmosphere is very limited. So that meant that there was a constant resupply of hydrogen, and it was one of the problems that the Russian scientists were working on, because they had realized from other measurements that the sun was being resupplied with hydrogen, and it was coming from the galactic environment. And so what my work showed was that the sun is acting like a comet, discharging the overall capacitor of the galaxy, and is forming this cometary tail of hydrogen. And a hydrogen it's the same process as a plasma discharge comet, forms this hydrogen ball, which is the Debye shielding around the sun. So it's a hydrogen cloud, just like a comet nucleus develops this hydrogen cloud and is being drawn into the comet nucleus. Okay, so anyway, this is the continual influx of hydrogen into the sun. And as I say, the Russians were studying it from a point of view of observing this hydrogen cloud outside of our solar system. And they were predicting a diminishing return on hydrogen in the future. And so anyway, they had this entire set of data which they didn't understand, and my work solidified. They also were talking about tornadoes on the sun. And so they would see literally tornadoes running across the surface of the sun, and they're going, what's causing this? And by the way, NASA finally discovered these another 15 years later and claimed like they had just discovered it. I won't even go there. But the Russians were the original discoverers of this. And of course, they didn't know what was causing this. So when they realized that on Earth, the tornadoes and the hurricanes and cyclonic storms, and on Mars, the tornadoes, the big dust devils, as they call them, were being powered by electrical discharges up to the ionosphere, they realized that clearly that it was not clouds rubbing together or something like that, that this was caused by vertical electric field and electrical discharges. I talked about the Tunguska event. Also, the issue with the 21 pieces of Schumacher-Levy 9, which crashed into the far side of Jupiter. And this was one of the very interesting developments of Schumacher-Levy 9. There were 20, by the way, this is the ninth comet discovered by Schumacher, Gene Schumacher, and Levy, which was a guy who they made a lot of comet discoveries together. But Gene Schumacher is an interesting case because he had an observatory in Australia. He was studying the big impact crater that's down in the outback of Australia. And one day he mysteriously dies in a car crash. And of course, I knew who he was, not personally, didn't meet him personally, but I know he was studying this. He was studying Hale-Bopp in his own observatory. And so anyway, what happens? The news comes back that he was driving his Jeep down in the base of this crater and he turned it over and he rolled out and got killed. Well, come on, you're not going to be racing. He's like a conservative guy. He's not going to be somehow racing around in this Jeep in the basin of this crater where he's going to flip it and die. And so that didn't make any sense. So then they said that he was up on top of the crater and he was coming out of the entryway onto the major highway, and one of these big outback they're like oil transport trucks that carry the oil in from the outback, and there's two or three big tanks, and you can see these things coming miles away because of the big dust cloud that follows behind them. And he claimed he was turning onto this dirt road outside the crater and he got hit by one of these and was killed. Well, nobody believed that story either. And so the end story was that he died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And of course, who's going to believe that story after the first two bogus stories were announced? So anyway, also his observatory was burned to the ground out in the middle of the outback, and he was collecting data on Hale-Bopp. So, you know, there's a very suspicious death. So now that we have three people, Robert Harrington, Chuck Schrammick, and Gene Schumacher, there was another group of seven astronomers who were, I believe it was seven, they were in a gondola car on a summer field trip in the French Alps. And they were there. They were Vatican astronomers. And the word was that they were going to go public with the story of Hale-Bopp. Well, this gondola car comes off of its wire and crashes down, killing all of them. And also the story of Malachi Martin. It looked like there were a lot of people that died trying to get the message out about Hale-Bopp, that it was not just this bigger-than-average comet. NASA said a nucleus 42 miles across, which is absolutely absurd. But it was planet-sized. Literally, the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was planet-sized. And eventually, it lost energy, it slowed down in its orbit, and the direct collision course with Earth moved ahead in its orbit, and we missed by basically a quarter year. That's how much energy this comet lost due to the tail drag. I can talk a little bit more about Malachi Martin, but he also met an untimely death, because he was the one that was exposing the Vatican as being related to Hale-Bopp. He said on the air on an Art Bell show that the Vatican asked NASA, is Hale-Bopp wormwood? In other words, is Hale-Bopp Planet X? Wormwood being the biblical term for Planet X. And of course it was. And so the real story of Planet X is that it came through the solar system. It was Hale-Bopp, and now it's going out of the solar system. Remember, Harrington originally, back when Sitchin was interviewing Harrington in 1986, Harrington's estimate at that time was that it was a 3,600-year orbit. And of course, that turned out to be incorrect the actual orbit was 4,250 years. And so this entire story of the Planet X 3,600 years was promulgated and propagated and repeated over and over and over again, and it had nothing to do with reality. The real orbit of Planet X, discovered by Harrington, was 4,250 years. But now, as Hale-Bopp had passed through the solar system and lost energy, the orbit is 2,600 years. It's losing about 40% per orbit. So, and when it comes through the solar system in another 2,600 years, or actually about 2,600 years, it will probably reduce its orbit down to about 1,300 years. And then maybe half of that again, 650 years. So in another 10,000 years, Hale-Bopp will be working its way in to become a planet. It's already in a closed orbit around the sun, etc. But getting back to the comet of Schumacher-Levy 9, 21 pieces of this comet, it broke apart on a close passage near Jupiter on a prior orbit, and on its way back, now it's on a direct collision course with Jupiter, but it's on the back side, the far side of Jupiter, where these comet pieces are going to crash. And so there's no observation possible from Earth, and nobody has any telescopic equipment on the far side of Jupiter. So there's no way to observe this. So the Russians, understanding that comets are not dirty snowballs, had all of their equipment, X-ray detectors, everything possible, was trained on Jupiter for the impacts of these 21 pieces of comet Schumacher-Levy 9. In the United States, NASA said, there's nothing to see there. Those are going to, little comet ball, ice balls are going to melt. They're going to go into the atmosphere. There won't be anything to see. So the U.S. had no instrumentation pointed at Jupiter for these 21 pieces, but the Russians captured it all. And as these comet pieces came into the near region of Jupiter, which has a high sulfur dioxide content, they changed magically into sulfur dioxide comets. And you'll see this photograph on the cover of my book, Comets. And it's an appropriate picture because it clearly proves that comets are not dirty snowballs, because how would these dirty snowballs know? When they got to a certain point, they changed to a sulfur dioxide comet. Well, that's because the reason is because they're discharging the local capacitor, which Jupiter has its own because it's a fusion-based star. And as it works in it, the available tail material in the region is sulfur dioxide. That's it. And the Russians understand this. The other thing that happened is as these pieces got close to Jupiter, they discharged the capacitor and they exploded into amazing amount of X-rays. And those X-rays bounced off the moons of Jupiter, which were on the far side of Jupiter, and were detectable at Earth on X-ray detectors, which were on Earth. And the Russians detected this and they came back and they said to me, they said, this is absolute proof, concrete proof that comets are not dirty snowballs. And, of course, the Western press, comets are dirty snowballs, just absolutely absurd. Okay, very important discovery there. Okay, so we're in this time frame from about the 1995 to 1999, somewhere in that time frame, a lot going on, not the least of which is in 1996, A group of astronomers from Goddard Space Flight Center accidentally turned one of the X-ray telescopes onto comet Hyakutake, which just happened to be passing very close to Earth. It looked like a big comet, actually was a very small comet. And so it's coming close to Earth, and they accidentally point this X-ray telescope at the comet and get this big influx of X-rays. So, of course, I contacted the people at Goddard and told them that I had predicted this in my original papers. And then they come up with this scheme to find another excuse for this with charge exchange. So here I'm going to American Geophysical Union meetings showing that comets exhibit X-rays and predicting that comets should have X-rays. And remember I told you about 10 years earlier, 1985, 86 time frame, when NASA, James Farquhar of the ISWE-3 satellite, is sending this out to Comet Giacobini-Zinner, and they turn off the X-ray detector, thinking they're going to save on batteries. And I tell them, do not turn off the X-ray detectors, because this will prove that comets are not dirty snowballs. And so they, of course, they go to NASA, and they come back with the opinion that, yes, turn off the detectors. There will not be any X-rays, because comets can't have dirty X-rays because they're little dirty snowballs. So anyway, they are actually accidentally discovered in 1996, and it turns out to be the Discovery Magazine, one of the top 10 scientific discoveries of the year. So you can go back to 1995. I don't remember which issue in Discovery Magazine, but the discovery of X-rays in comets was one of the top 10 discoveries of the year, but it was an experimental discovery. Nobody in the world ever expected comets to produce X-rays. And so I predicted it. You'll see it in my papers. I've talked about this before. And of course, here we are with Schumacher-Levy 9, the 21 pieces of the comet coming in. And as they approach Jupiter, give off these tremendous X-ray explosions, which you would never get from a dirty snowball. How would a dirty snowball coming into the atmosphere of Jupiter cause a huge X-ray explosion to the extent that you could see the X-rays reflected off the moons of Jupiter? These moons are small, they're distant, and there's enough X-rays that they reflect off the moons and are detectable at Earth. These are incredibly huge explosions, and they're electromagnetic, proving, as the Russians stated conclusively, that my theory was correct. The dirty snowball concept is, you know, their comment was the last nail in the coffin. And of course, anyway, life goes on in the Western world of disinformation. Okay, on with other discoveries. In the process of talking to the Russian scientists, just a few anecdotes here, I would talk about their personal life. And so these professors lived on campus at the University of Novosibirsk, were paid about $75 a month. That was their salary. They lived on campus, and they lived in like campus-type housing. And that's what they had to do to basically, they were, you know, it wasn't a high-paying job, let's put it this way. But these guys were honest. They were very hardworking, very diligent, and very good, and worked with the equipment that they had. But at any rate, we got to talking about the Apollo space program and the U.S. space program and the Apollo moon landing issue, etc. And they just laughed. They said, we know that the United States never went to the moon, but how could Russian scientists say that, because nobody in the West would ever believe a Russian scientist? And they said that they had been, the Russian space program back in the 60s, before the Apollo program ever came about, the Russians were doing daily launches into low Earth orbit, and they had plenty of rocket power. Remember, I talked about the Cosmos Orbiter, the little mini shuttle that they would send up because they had so much payload capacity. They didn't have even their orbiting little space stations. They had extra capacity. And so anyway, they sent a manned mission to orbit the moon and come back, which they had plenty of rocket power. And when the astronauts came back, they were very dead. They had gone through the Van Allen belts, and what happened is the radiation was so intense. What happens is the protons and the electrons hit metal, they create X-rays, and it was X-ray, severe X-ray burns. They were, you know, they died, the astronauts or cosmonauts, basically killed from X-ray, just like, say, people at Chernobyl would have died from serious X-ray and gamma ray or, you know, radiation from being near the X-ray sources and burned. That's how these cosmonauts came back. And so they said, wow, we don't know how to get through these belts. And furthermore, NASA does not either, so NASA never went to the moon. That's what the Russians told me. I'm just repeating what they told me. And of course, there's a lot of other issues with the so-called Apollo space program, which the people going into space now still don't have a solution. And so it was, anyway, it was Comet Hyakutake, which was the first comet to have X-rays discovered. And then they turned it onto Hale-Bopp, which was up in the sky. That comet had X-rays. Then they started looking at more and more comets, and all these comets have X-rays out to the sunward side. And, of course, then they said, oh, this is due to charge exchange. I knew the people that were involved in the charge exchange hoax, I would call it, Tom Cravens. And these are very good scientists, by the way, but misguided. Eventually, a group of scientists, I believe they were in Norway, reviewed the data that came from the examination of the Hyakutake data, and they said these are not, it's not the same kind of spectrum you would find from ion exchange. These are Bremsstrahlung X-rays, and that's what I had predicted, because as the electron beam comes out from the sun, it starts seeing the negative charge on the comet nucleus, and it starts to slow them down. That's what a breaking X-ray is. And that's the same technique, of course, that they use in the dental X-ray machine, etc., to create X-rays. Okay, so on to the weather work. Now, here's some of the most important work that came out of the collaboration, because they had been studying atmospheric electricity, things like ball lightning, which I've talked about before. That's my work also that goes back to the magnetic propulsion systems and the battery that powers the plasma tubes, etc., for the electromagnetic propulsion system, is a ball lightning, which is a phenomenon where you break apart the hydrogen and it becomes basically a superatom. And that's the same situation happening with the sun, where you have the solar corona, relativistic electrons in orbit around the positively charged solar surface. And so at any rate, that's another issue. But back to weather, they did not know what caused hurricanes, cyclonic storms, tornadoes, etc. They saw the tornadoes on the sun and they're going, what's this all about? They had already understood that there were the big dust devils on Mars. Russians were some of the first people to get to Mars and understand the weather patterns there, etc. Also had photographed hurricanes. The Hubble Space Telescope had photographed hurricanes on Mars, but how does a hurricane form? Because if they're supposedly formed because of warm water, there's no water at all on Mars, so how did this hurricane form on Mars? So clearly, hurricanes, etc., are formed by some other process. Well, you know, my work transcended what Tesla did relative to atmospheric electricity, and I understood where the electric fields came from, something that Tesla did not understand. He knew that they were there, he could measure them, but he didn't know what caused them or what sustained the voltage, etc., because electrical capacitors leak. They don't just stay there forever. So what's causing this vertical electric field on Earth? What's supplementing its power on a continual basis? Tesla did not know. And so anyway, the issue was what caused these cyclonic storms. And so I explained that it's the vertical electric field, and this is what causes the hurricanes to form. And then we also came up with the control mechanism that if you take a laser beam, a satellite laser beam, you could drag the hurricane offshore off of its normal path by discharging the vertical electric field and guiding the hurricane so it did not make landfall. Now, the Russians don't have a problem with hurricanes. They don't have a problem with tornadoes. For some reason, the United States does. And so anyway, the other mechanism for facilitating or mitigating hurricanes was to put a series of grounds offshore. And so in the continental shelf that approaches, say, Florida or the Yucatan Peninsula or Central America where hurricanes come in, you put a series of grounding buoys. And so there's a chain going down, there's an anchor, and then you have basically a weather balloon going up that holds this conducting rod. And so what causes a hurricane to lose its energy? Well, the standard reason is that it hits shore and it sort of some reason breaks up. There's really no standard explanation, but the true explanation from my model is that when the hurricane reaches landfall, the front edge of the electrical discharge starts discharging to ground and it shorts it out. And that's why the leading edge of the hurricane is full of tornadoes. A lot of people don't understand that as a hurricane makes landfall, the majority of damage is not from the eye of the hurricane, it's from the tornadoes on the leading edge. And that also drops a lot of rain, and that's where the majority of damage comes from when a tornado hits landfall. And so what you do is you put this series of buoys out from the shoreline, and you short-circuit the hurricane maybe 10 miles out, maybe 20 miles out before it ever gets to land, and you drive all the energy out of the storm and the water drops. The winds slow down and the water drops. So you take the water and you take the electrical current out of the hurricane, diminishing its strength before it makes landfall. And also you have the ability to drag it offshore with the laser beams. Well, it turns out that this information, the person in charge of the Millennium Group took this information to the U.S. military in the late 1990s. And this was an effort based on all of us saying, look, we can mitigate hurricanes using this technology. The U.S. military takes it and develops it into a weapon of war and starts sending up laser satellites in the early 2000s. They were pretending that they were communication satellites, but we knew what they were. The Russian scientists go to the United Nations and say, look, the technology we developed, the United States is developing them into military weapons, and you have to stop this because this is against international law. At that point, the United States refused to sign the treaties. This was in the term of George Bush Jr. The United States refused to sign the United Nations treaties banning military use of weapons control for weather control as a military weapon. And specifically, you could not use it against your own population. And that's why the United States would not sign that treaty, because they fully intended to use it, which they did for Katrina, for other. That's when all of the storm manipulation began. And when you develop something for peaceful purposes, for the benefit of mankind, and then it becomes used for military purposes against the people. So I've been an outspoken person on this for literally since then, well over two decades now, against the use of military-grade satellites, laser satellites, in the use of weather control. It's used along with other techniques like chemtrail spraying, etc. But the many, many times hurricanes have been manipulated to cause social, economic, and physical destruction. Recently, for example, there was the destruction of the rice crop along the Texas-Louisiana border. Just another example. This is changing gears a little bit, going away from what I did with the Russians. During this time frame also, I was working with different experimental setups to understand how to test in a laboratory environment, and in a very simple laboratory environment, the induced electric dipole redshift, which was the cause of redshifts. And there are no black holes. The effects that you see are actually due to this effect on light. It's that the light photons have a charge pair, negative, positive charge pair. And when they break apart in pair production, where you have, for example, an electron and a positron, the charges are there. There's no energy loss or gain, and the energy in the photon converts into the positron and the electron. But where did the charges come from? They had to be in the photon also. And so what I developed was the understanding that the this force was there if you have non-uniform electric fields. And of course, no one would ever imagine this unless you understood that the fusion-based objects like the sun or the galactic nucleus or other stars or quasars, etc., had fusion and a very high non-uniform electric field surrounding them. And of course, as photons move out over very long distances, would become redshifted, never blue-shifted, always a redshift. And that's why when you look out in the universe, you see redshifts, because it's the induced electric dipole redshift. So at any rate, I was looking for a laboratory experiment to prove this. And when I was teaching physics at the university level, this was in the Minnesota university system, there was equipment in the laboratory. And so I went back in, and they had a Tesla coil, and these are short. I mean, you can buy these little experimental devices. And it just has a high, I think it was like 300,000 plus and minus 300,000 volts. I can't remember the specs on this particular one. But it had like this nail sticking up. And you could do experiments like hold a fluorescent light, and it would light up the light bulb without another pole on it. And without a completed circuit, because it was AC current basically going on. And so anyway, what I said is, wow, this the tip of this Tesla little coil has a very high non-uniform electric field. So I took a laser from the laboratory, shined it across the tip and down the hallway, down this long hallway, and sure enough, the beam dropped down. And so the beam was, you could see it oscillating up and down with the changing electric field on the Tesla coil, proving the induced electric dipole redshift. So it's a very simple mechanism. So I actually showed this to students as part of the physics program, showing them that this is a laboratory verifiable phenomenon. And so oddly enough, you could never get this published in a journal, because it would tear apart all of cosmology, because they base it on this ridiculous redshift that the universe is expanding. Well, the universe is not expanding. The redshift is due to the induced electric dipole redshift, and it's laboratory verifiable. So that came through this same time frame, although I had done other experiments previously. This was the simplest and best example of the induced electric dipole redshift, which you can readily understand, any student can repeat this in a laboratory. And also, it's interesting that the beam of the laser would always be pulled down, never up. And the reason is, as the voltage swung up to a positive and then, say, down to a negative, what happens is that the dipole in the light photon flips. If the positive field is up, then the negative, the electron is down. And if the electric field is down, then the proton is up and the electron is down. But the induced electric dipole force is always attractive. So it always pulls the beam down. So the beam would be stretched down, because as the voltage went through zero, then, of course, there's no voltage at all, and the beam would be straight. So basically what it does is stretches the beam downwards, just elongates the beam from where its central point was normally downwards. Very simple experiment to do. It can be done in any student laboratory with very basic equipment. And there's one point I have to go back here. I was talking about the Canary Island Conference of the European Space Agency, the HALE-BOP, a very famous conference, HALE-BOP conference, Canary Islands. And when this was first announced in March of 1997, I immediately wrote to them. I gave them a topic of my paper dealing with the plasma discharge comet model, and I was immediately put on the docket. They said, absolutely, you have a front and center spot to speak. This is a 3-day conference. And then when the NASA scientists started coming in and they saw my name on the conference, they objected. And they got the European Space Agency to write to me and tell me that there just wasn't room enough for me on the conference docket anymore. So anyway, it just shows these people. And of course, this would have been an explosive event, to say the least, because I was on the Art Bell show and calling the main people, Hal Weaver, Ollie Hynow, and the other astronomers there, calling them liars and pointing out that the initial topic on the whole conference, as it turned out, was about the companion of Hale-Bopp. So they were 100% aware that there was a companion to Hale-Bopp, but the news media was never informed reverse the public opinion of Art Bell, putting something on his webpage. Literally what Art Bell put on his webpage was 100% correct, coming from Chuck Schrammick and Courtney Brown, the photo showing Hale-Bopp with a companion, which, as I said, NASA itself published the initial video, a complete video of the Hale-Bopp nucleus with its orbiting companion. Two comets orbiting each other, basically, when the Hale-Bopp was very first discovered. Okay, now there is a story. It's still on the internet, and you can see this. I made a major discovery one day, because during the Hale-Bopp era, we were looking at SOHO satellite, which is the NASA satellite, solar observatory satellite. And one day, there's a characteristic of the when high-energy protons hit the sensor that's in the camera. It's like a digital sensor. It looks like rays shooting out, and these would happen occasionally. But one day that there was just a storm of relativistic protons that hit the detector. But the thing was that it was the first time we saw relativistic protons, and I knew this because of the time frame of the light. In other words, the visible part of the storm coming off the surface of the sun was visible, and the protons hit the detector at the same time, meaning that the protons were coming to us at the speed of light. So I immediately wrote a paper and sent it not only to NASA, but also to publications stating that the sun was putting out cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are relativistic protons, previously believed to only come from supernova and galactic nuclei, places like that, where there are very high energy processes going on. But here our own sun, solar flare, had produced cosmic rays, relativistic protons. And so there's a, you can see this, just if you can search, do a Google search, your favorite search engine, and look for cosmic rays from the sun. And you'll see my article, which appeared in the Millennium Group page relative to this discovery. So I discovered another Nobel Prize winning discovery that I made, which was stolen by NASA. And then when I complained, they said, well, only the principal investigators get to make discoveries. The old principal investigator, baloney again. But the reality was that the principal investigators didn't even see it. They didn't know about it until they read my work. You know, these people are so corrupt. That's all I can tell you. I lived my entire career working independently. I make the discoveries. They steal it and try and the same way with the discovery of X-rays. It should have been discovered decades earlier. And because of NASA, it was not discovered. It was only discovered by accident. And then they claim that they know all about it. Just corrupt. That's the only word you can use. Mentally, spiritually, and professionally corrupt people. Okay, so now I want to mention that in the appendix of my weather book, it's the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. In the appendix, you will find a series, not everything certainly, but a series of emails, exchanges, and information exchanges between me and the Russian scientists. And that's put there as just a sample of the communications that went on. So at any rate, I think it's important for the record to establish that communication. Eventually, I don't know, I'm sure it was the CIA that got involved to make sure that my corroboration with the Russians ended. My experience, just be honest with you, the scientists, engineering, especially as you get up to the higher levels in the United States, you enter this level of pure corruption. In Russia, these scientists were very poorly paid, but were very honest, very hardworking, and were true scientists. Okay, now another thing happened, totally independent of everything I've been talking about. A friend of mine, and this I got to know this guy because he was very interested in my work and helping me out, basically, and I communicated with this guy probably every day. And I'm just going to call him Bill. That was his first name. And he was a guy that was, he was raised in Texas, and he had a grandfather, remember, he used to tell me this story. His grandfather owned a ranch, and he'd go out to Grandpa's ranch, and he said, Grandpa, back in the 30s, there was a Great Depression. What happened to you? And Grandpa says, well, I heard there was one. In other words, Grandpa lived on his ranch, had everything he needed there, all his food, everything he needed, and the Great Depression didn't affect him at all. He just lived on his ranch in Texas and everything he needed, etc. But anyway, Bill listened to a lot of radio shows. And so he listened to all these different radio shows, and every day he'd come back and tell me what was being talked about, what were the important issues. And that alleviated me from just, I didn't have time to listen to all of this. But Bill, as a young kid, and he used to tell me about this, he said as a young kid, his grandmother would take him aside and show him this book. And it turned out to be the Bronze Book of Britain, the old Celtic book. And his grandma had a copy. But at any rate, he knew that this book existed, but it was not the only one, that there was a series of books. And he didn't know anything about it, but he had educated himself, very intelligent guy, really didn't have college education, but very intelligent, very well read, understood the workings of the world, the political chaos in the world. He understood about the European bankers and the control, etc. But he went on a quest, and with a guy named Dick. I'm just going to call him Dick because I believe he's still alive. And Dick ran a religious, I wouldn't say a religious, but a study group, let's put it that way, in the United States, and had a good following. And Bill and him went out searching for these ancient books. And one day he came back to me and he said, I found it. I found the books that I was looking for. And he had made a connection with a group, and I'm not going to talk any more about this, the details, because some of this history is online and you can go look what's available, but a group called the Chaldean Trust. They had been in the process in this time frame, early 90s, of putting out a book that had been held in literally in trust by another group, another trust group, and they put together what is now known as the Kolbrin, K-O-L-B-R-I-N, a book that's still available. And so Bill made arrangements to get three copies of this, one for Dick, one for himself, and one for me. And once he had made this contact, of course, my name came up, and the group wanted to get a copy of the Kolbrin to me, because they knew of my science reputation and archaeology, etc. They wanted me to read it and interpret what it said. And so anyway, just a little bit of history here. What happened is, after the crucifixion of Christ, if you remember from your Bible, a man named Joseph of Arimathea came to claim the body of Christ. After the crucifixion, from the cross, Christ is on the ground now, he's dead. They had pierced his side with a lance, so water came out. That was their symbol that he was completely devoid of blood and dead. And so Joseph of Arimathea comes and claims his body. Now, in Rome, not just anybody could come and claim a body. And it turns out that Joseph of Arimathea was Mary's uncle. So this is Christ's great uncle who's claiming his body. Well, Joseph of Arimathea was a very rich, wealthy Roman businessman, but I've talked about this before. I don't have enough time to go into all the detail here, but he was basically they called him the metal man of the Roman Empire, because Rome itself, Italy itself, did not have metal resources. A very rocky country. And the metal resources came from England, which was occupied by the Celts, and the Romans couldn't go there. So, and the Celts were the descendants of the people that came out of Egypt with Moses. They were Israelites. And so they had now occupied the British Isles, Ireland, and the Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Finland, Norway, especially Norway, where my ancestors, the Vikings, came from, etc. And so at any rate, Joseph of Arimathea, Christ had spent a lot of time with him as a young boy. And they went a lot of times to England, etc. And there are records of Christ being in England with Joseph of Arimathea. So Joseph of Arimathea was the go-between for all the metal of the Roman Empire in Rome and England, where the metals, the different types of metals, were basically mined from the ground. And so after the crucifixion, Joseph, by the way, happened to be, besides a very wealthy businessman, he happened to be very interested in history, and he had a vast library. And so after the crucifixion, the way it is told is that he took the cross, the chalice from the Last Supper, and other artifacts, cloth that Christ was buried with, etc., and he took them to England. He already had established a location at what is now Glastonbury, and started basically an outpost there. And he took his books, his library, and various other things, and he took the two Marys, Mary Magdalene and Mary Mother of Jesus, to England, where they lived out their lives there. This was a place that the Romans could never get to because of the Celts. And so anyway, the story is that the Romans finally sent out an entourage of warriors to penetrate, and when the people from the abbey knew that they were coming, they took as much of the library as they could with them, and then after the Romans burnt down their facility there and destroyed it, they came and they picked up out of the ashes what was left of the books, etc., that they couldn't carry. So all of this was then handed down in a trust, because they understood that this would not the Romans were trying to destroy this. So this was hidden for a long period of time and kept, and these would appear at a periods of time, but in England. So the Bronze Book of England was something that came out of this. But the Colburn was a compilation of books from the library of Joseph of Arimathea. And that's the history of the Colburn. And then I'm not going to go into a lot more detail. There's a lot more involved here, but it's literally the books that were available at the time of Christ. You know, remember that the Bible that you see today went through the monasteries of the Middle Ages, were rewritten, reinterpreted many times, and changed many times up to the modern version you see today. So you still see some of the lineage if you go from Noah to Moses and the etc. all the way down to Christ, the Hebrews. The Israelites, anyway, that's a whole nother story, because these were a very different group, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and they populated Eastern Europe. I've talked about this on my main radio show a number of times, and eventually populating Norway. The Vikings were the descendants, the Celts. And then my ancestors were Vikings who settled on the north and west coast of Ireland and eventually became Irish that moved to the United States. My ancestors came to the United States in the late 1800s. Okay, so at any rate, this is the story of the Colburn. So one of these copies that was put together by the Chaldean Trust and then published, I got one of the first three copies to come into the United States. I open it up, and it's this beautiful, gorgeously bound book with the Celtic symbol on the cover. I open it up, and I start reading it. And it's all about comets and ancient destruction of man and the comets up in the sky fighting together, etc. And basically is a figurative compilation of the destruction of Earth. And it's very exact compared to what you read in the Mayan Popol Vuh and what the Incas talk about, etc. The Quetzalcoatl was the name they gave to it. Or to the American Indians, the Southwest, the Phoenix, etc. And the Chinese, the dragon, the Chinese and the Japanese talk about the dragon serpent, etc. Quetzalcoatl is the plumed serpent god, and sometimes in the form of a snake. The Moses event, etc. So anyway, the Colburn is not only describing this, but other events. And then it goes through a series of books on how to live, about making sure there's no usury fees, etc. And these are the old texts, which have been totally obfuscated in the modern Bible. There's a trace of it, but since they really didn't understand what happened, they couldn't. They did not leave this in what you call a standard Bible today. So this circumvented all of the changes that went about in the modern Bible. The Colburn is not a Bible, it's a compilation of books. And so early on it was called the Colburn Bible. It's not a Bible, it's a compilation of books from the Library of Joseph Arimathea. And this eventually led to my getting permission to publish bits and pieces of the Colburn and my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, because what I was doing, I was talking to people about Tesla and the Atlantis, and they said, you got to put this down in a book. So anyway, I'll pick up next week and that's going up into the 2000s. So I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but I'm just talking about the source of the Colburn and all of this, convergence of information at this period of time in the mid to late 1990s. Once again, visit my webpage. This is brought to you commercial-free, jmccwaterfilters.com and jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.